This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran categorically rejects a Western media report about enriching uranium to levels above 60%, saying the report seeks to distort the realities. North Korea fires warm ballistic missiles in response to the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula and its joint military drills with the South. Also ahead, Moscow says the West shows no willingness to peacefully resolve the conflict in Ukraine as NATO allies push for more weapons for Kiev. Welcome. Our top story, Iran has rejected a report by the news website Bloomberg claiming inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency have found enriched uranium beyond permitted levels. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalvandi, said it is regrettable the UN nuclear watchdog is being used as a political lever to put pressure on Tehran. He added, Bloomberg's report is aimed at distorting the realities. The spokesman said the existence of uranium particles with over 60% purity level during the enrichment process does not mean uranium has been enriched at that level. What matters, he said, is the end product, adding Iran has never enriched uranium to purity levels of more than 60%. In its report, Bloomberg claimed that IAEA inspectors had discovered Iran enriched uranium with a purity level of 84%. The 59th annual Munich Security Conference has wrapped up. Unlike previous years, Germany did not invite any representative from Tehran, but instead chose to give the limelight to unelected anti-Iran individuals with no mandate other than from Western media and politicians.
The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, three notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The three anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change. Ali Nejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Ali Nejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Today marks the 15th day of the hunger strike by a senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the resistance movement held in an Israeli jail. To discuss that further, we were joined by our guests earlier in this program. Let's see what they had to say.
Stay tuned for this edition of the News Review. It's the 15th day of a hunger strike by a senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement held in an Israeli jail. Qadr Adnan is protesting against the extension of solitary confinement. The 44-year-old was arrested during a raid on his home near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. He's been arrested 12 times and spent nearly 8 years behind bars. More than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Hamas's movement has vowed to continue its support for the Palestinians in prisons. Hamas says the Tel Aviv regime is subjecting the detainees to the most brutal forms of abuse. Israel has recently stepped up its crackdown. In protest of atrocities, the Palestinians have launched a general strike in the occupied Al-Quds and several West Bank cities. Okay, now let's call in our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, and ask her more about this. Mona, good to have you with us. So tell us about the situation in general of the Palestinians held in Israeli jails, what's going on there, and this specific case in point, Adnan.
Well, speaking in general about Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails, we are speaking today about over 4,500 Palestinians held in a number of Israeli jails in very difficult situation and under inhumane conditions. We also speak about hundreds of Palestinians who are kept behind bars without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention that is illegal. This administrative detention allows the Israeli authorities to keep Palestinians behind bars for indefinite periods of time without telling the lawyers and the prisoners themselves why in the first place those Palestinians had been arrested. They claim, the Israelis, of course, continue to claim that they have secret information that allows the Israelis to keep Palestinians behind bars without telling the lawyers what are these reasons. But human rights organizations and prisoners groups say that it's another tool by the Israeli authorities to keep holding Palestinians, punishing them for any form of resistance, for expressing their point of view, for rejecting the Israeli occupation and their first place. Anyway, the Israelis have arrested Khadr Adnan on the 5th of this month from his hometown, Arabi, in Jenin. And the moment he was arrested, he immediately heard that he starts an upended hunger strike. Because speaking about Khadr Adnan, the senior leader of the jihad movement, Khadr Adnan has been arrested by the Israelis at least 11 times in the past, and he was engaged in a number of hunger strikes against the illegal detention, the so-called administrative detention. This time, the Israelis had been extending his arrest, claiming that he's under arrest to continue the interrogations against him. But Khadr Adnan knows very well that at the end of the day, there are no clear charges against him. The Israelis would be holding him under the so-called administrative detention. And because he declared an open-ended hunger strike, the Israeli jailers put him in solitary confinement. As you have said, for 15 days, he had been refusing food. And he had been in an open-ended hunger strike. We have to mention that Khadr Adnan, of course, seen by many Palestinian prisoners as a symbol for starting the hunger strike. In 2004, he continued the hunger strike that lasted for 25 days. In 2012, his hunger strike lasted for 67 days, and these hunger strikes were to pressurize the Israeli prison authorities to either release him or prosecute him, but not to keep him behind bars without charge or trial.
Okay. Now, Mazen Gomsia, a Palestinian scientist and author, is also joining me from Bethlehem. Good to have you with us, sir. So, Mazen, tell us about, in the first place, as Mona put it, administrative detention itself, you know, it's questionable. You don't know what charges are leveled against you. You're held for whatever period they want to. And then, apart from that, we have lots of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Doesn't the Tel Aviv regime have this responsibility as an occupation force? Don't they have any functions or responsibilities when it comes to the health condition of the people that they are holding behind bars? Because we hear reports of torture, we hear lots of limitations, against them. They are not allowed to visit their families, so they are going on hunger strike. Sometimes they have no access to lawyers either.
Yes, over the past 76 years since the foundation of the State of Israel, basically over 1 million Palestinians spent some time in Israeli gulags. And I hate to use the word prisons because they are really not appropriate in such terminology. Israel, as an occupying army, is obligated under international law to respect things like the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Fourth Geneva Convention, for example, prohibits the occupying force from torturing and otherwise mistreating what's referred to in international law as protected people, civilians under occupation. And the fact that civilians resist also occupation is not an excuse to do collective punishment, which Israel does, or to transfer its own population into occupied territories and take some of the existing population and put it in gulags inside the Green Line. This is not acceptable under international law, and certainly the process of administrative detention is also not acceptable under international law.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mona Candila, correspondent, Ramallah, Mazen Gomsia, Palestinian scientist and author in Bethlehem.
Moving on, North Korea has launched more projectiles a day after firing an intercontinental ballistic missile that landed off Japan's coast. The South Korean and Japanese militaries say the two short-range ballistic missiles were fired within minutes of each other early Monday. They reportedly landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. The launch comes a day after a joint U.S.-South Korea military drills. In response, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warned against increased U.S. presence in the region. She said the North could turn the Pacific into a, quote, firing range, depending on U.S. forces' movements. Tensions are running high on the Korean Peninsula as the North views America's war games with its regional allies as provocative and rehearsals for an invasion. Moscow says the United States is a, quote, major provocateur of international tensions after Washington expressed support for Ukraine's attack on Russian-annexed Crimea. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the remarks by American officials about Crimea underscored the depth of disagreements between the two countries. He was responding to the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland, who had also called for Crimea to be demilitarized. Peskov added that Kiev and its Western allies have not shown any willingness to peacefully resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Russia says Western countries are prolonging the war in Ukraine by pouring military aid into the country. The West, however, has ignored the warning. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has been urging Western countries to provide more military aid to Ukraine.
Zelensky and the Ukrainians have a lot of applaudissement and not enough ammunition. That's the paradox. They need to be less applauded and better supplied with arms. The Ukrainians are fighting, paying the highest price in terms of lives. But this war happens in European soil, affects us, and has a global impact around the world, which also affects our security.
Borrell made the comments at the Munich Security Conference. There, Ukrainian officials urged U.S. Congress members to press the administration of President Joe Biden to send F-16 fighter jets to Kiev. Ukraine says the jets would boost Kiev's ability to hit Russian missile units. Washington has been reluctant to send the warplanes, but the proposal is supported by Congress. The U.S. has provided at least $30 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the war in February last year. Meanwhile, Russia has accused Ukraine of planning to stage a nuclear incident on its territory to pin the blame on Moscow ahead of a UN meeting to discuss the deadly conflict. The Russian Defense Ministry said radioactive substances had been transported to Ukraine from a European country as Kiev was preparing, quote, a large-scale provocation. Moscow has repeatedly accused Kiev of planning false flag operations with non-conventional weapons using biological or radioactive materials. In the past, Russia also expressed concern about the use of what it called dirty bombs by Ukraine. Kiev and its allies have dismissed such accusations as cynical attempts to spread disinformation. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
With the Western media being silent about the US-backed Saudi-led war against Yemen, it truly makes us wonder what other atrocities the United States are hiding from the public regarding its foreign affairs. How many more war crimes are the United States involved in that most of the public are unaware of? In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Anti-war noted, despite the severity of the US-backed Saudi-led war against Yemen, the Western press has covered extraordinarily little of the war. Between 2015 and 2019, the media only covered about 92 minutes of the ongoing war. Based on the atrocities, this is shockingly low. MSNBC even went an entire year without mentioning the conflict. With this in hand, you might be asking yourself, why isn't the Western media covering this? The reasoning for this is because the United States would be seen as bad guys. Ever since the US involvement in the war, the United States has done nothing but harm to the region. Not even a year into United States involvement, and the United States was already being accused of war crimes by the Human Rights Watch. They reported 10 unlawful air strikes by the Saudi-led coalition led to over 300 civilians dying and 400 more wounded in 2015. In October 2016, a Saudi Arabian bomb was dropped on funeral ceremony in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. Over 100 people died and 500 wounded, many of whom were children, in an apparent war crime. Footage shows charred and mutilated bodies strewn in and outside of the funeral hall. Another horrible incident occurred in September 2018 when a bomb was dropped on a school bus on a field trip. Many of the children on board were under the age of 15, and all 40 of the children would die in another war crime. To make things worse for the United States, who is on the side of Saudi Arabia, these bombs were manufactured by an American company called Lockheed Martin. The Saudi-led coalition continued to do harm towards the people of Yemen. They would begin to target grain silos, livestock, horses, irrigation systems, trucks, and other aspects of food distribution. The United States has continued to make the humanitarian crisis even worse by installing a naval blockade on the country that had become 90% dependent. If these pieces of news became more mainstream, then people would be irate at the United States. If any other country were doing the same thing to another country, we would be livid at that country for their war crimes, yet we turn a blind eye to the crisis that the US helped to start. Anti-war also noted the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. Between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, according to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisitions and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. The United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. As WikiLeaks Yemen flies prove, the United States was one of the biggest supporters of military in Yemen. Also, World Socialist website noted, Britain and the United States provided the Saudi-led coalition with the weapons used in hundreds of attacks on civilians in Yemen between January 2021 and the end of February 2022, according to a recent report by Oxfam. Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, said that the Saudi-led coalition were responsible for at least 87 civilian deaths and 136 injuries, 19 attacks on healthcare facilities, and 293 attacks that forced people to flee their homes, 39% of all attacks causing displacement. Our analysis shows there is a pattern of violence against civilians, and all sides in this conflict have not done enough to protect civilian life, which they are obliged to do under international humanitarian law. He added, the intensity of these attacks would not have been possible without a ready supply of arms. That is why it's vital the UK government and others must immediately stop the arms sales that are fueling war in Yemen. The Oxfam report came just days before the Campaign Against Arms Trade, CAAT, launched a lawsuit aimed at ending the British government's multi-billion pound arms sales, including Typhoon fighter jets, missiles and bombs, as well as ongoing maintenance and support for use in Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates' led war in Yemen. The UK government's own rules, adopted in 2014 when it signed the Arms Trade Treaty, prohibit arms sales where there is a clear risk that a weapon might be used in a serious violation of international humanitarian law, IHL. Despite the overwhelming evidence that the coalition has repeatedly breached IHL, the government has continued to promote and protect weapon sales. According to CAAT, the UK has supplied arms worth over £23 billion to Saudi Arabia when open licenses are taken into account, several times the official figures provided by the government since the war in Yemen began in April 2015. UK special forces are believed to have played a role in the war, while the British military maintains the Saudi warplanes that attack Yemen and provide intelligence support for the coalition. The British government has persistently rejected calls from the UN and other international bodies for a ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It boasts of being the second largest exporter of defense items worldwide after the US, based on the value of orders or contracts signed, with more than half by value going to the West Asia region.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody. Today is the 28th of Rajab, the day when the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was forced to leave his hometown, Medina, because of the pressures of the Umayyad rulers. Here is what the martyr of Karbala has said in order to awaken the conscience of the seekers of truth and justice who never yield to oppression. Yazid is a corrupt man who imbibes wine, puts to death the soul which Allah forbids to be harmed, and declares his debauchery in public. A man like me will never give pledge of allegiance to a man like him.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, moderation in practice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of moderation in practices in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized us to ponder on the verses of the Quran, to ponder about our life, to ponder on the signs that are provided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this pondering and thinking will result in a good character. This will result in a moderate way. Therefore, when we want to practice something, it is better to practice in a moderate way. Why? Because those who do not follow the moderate way in their life, in their practices, they are known as musrifin, the extravagance, those who are extravagance. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has clearly said in the Quran that those who are extravagant, Allah never likes them. Allah never loves them. And these are the ones who are spreading corruption in this world. In the verse of Quran, as Allah has said, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ. Do not follow the command of the extravagants. الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. These are the people who have caused corruption in this earth. وَلَا يُسْلِحُونَ. And they are not the guided ones. They are not the reformers. Therefore, if we want to reform ourselves, if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, if we want to have the life which will take us towards the perfection, therefore it is necessary to have this moderation in our practices, this moderation in our routine life, in our actions. And with our actions, we must prove that we are the moderate ones, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of moderation in practices in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary to practice moderation in our life so that we are not from the extravagance. We are different from them. And Allah likes those who are following the moderate way. Why? Because this moderate way is in line with the justice. And Allah is just. Allah is adil. He has ordered us to follow the path of adl and qist, which is known as justice, which is known as equality, which is known as to not to perform extravagance. Therefore, this moderation in the practices will lead us to have a peaceful life, to have a peaceful life, to have a beneficial life, even for the others, not only for us. Therefore, it is necessary upon every single Muslim when they think of the Islamic lifestyle, when they think to have the Islamic lifestyle, they must observe this moderation in their practices. You know, for example, if we are praying and if we want to have the nearness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through worshipping, and if we see someone who's praying all day, maybe he says like the monks, if they separate themselves, or sometimes in Sufism we have such things, that they separate themselves from this world and they just go towards worshipping. So they exceed the limits, and whole day they're praying and they're not working, they're not earning anything for themselves. It's the others who are bringing food for them or helping them. This is not something which Allah wants us. Allah wants us to pray on time. He wants us to look after our family. He wants us to socialize with the people. He wants us to live in the community. He wants us to enjoy our life. He wants us to have some time for the rest, some time for ourselves. And there is a specific time for praying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is the moderate way of acting or living or practicing, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Democracy in History. Part 1.
Rome, the sacred Christian empire. The land of war and glory. The land of great churches and hidden Mithraism temples. A land built on the remains of Greece, Greek gods, Greek memories, with colonies in three continents and a great eastern enemy, Iran. The land of Persia, the land of Ahura. A land stretching from the Indus to the Nile, with rulers chosen by Ahura Mazda and soldiers adorned in steel to the teeth. A land that went down on its knees by Alexander's attack, but was not destroyed. And Greece, ancient Greece. The glorious Mediterranean civilization and its gods, theaters, and philosophers. An ancient civilization that dates back 2,000 years with unique methods of ruling over people. People who built those governments and their methods of governance over themselves. Athens, 392 BC. Socrates is accused of impiety and corrupting the minds of the youth of Athens. The jury at his trial found Socrates guilty and sentenced him to drinking the poison hemlock. Socrates says people do not like to have their knowledge questioned, but I know that I know nothing. This sentence led Socrates to death in Athens. As Plato puts it, Socrates was the first victim of democracy.
This is a betrayal of our gods. We're giving the reins of affairs to a bunch of people who are thirsty for fame, position, and money. They are destroying the main role of traditions.
Socrates believed that just as a shoemaker or mason needed skills to do his job, a governor needed to be skilled too, to have the political knowledge to rule. Socrates made fun of Greece's democracy and believed that competence and eligibility were needed for a government. The biggest claimants to that eligibility were Athenian noblemen and wealthy people who thought their origin and pedigree already provided them with that competence. But Socrates believed that this competence and knowledge could be achieved by training and education.
None of them wanted to have anything to do with morality or justice. They wanted to have nothing to do with intelligence or knowledge. They just wanted power and a system based on the fight for political survival and even lies and deception. Let me put it this way. You can fully realize the meaning of democracy if you compare it to other political systems. Demagogism is the opposite form of democracy. Socrates believed that their version of democracy was in fact another form of demagogism.
Socrates said, if you kill a man like me, you will hurt yourself more than you hurt me. But he didn't mean the court, he meant the people of Athens. We remember the Athenians for their democracy today. But this is not their reality. Athens had three social groups: the rich and nobles, craftsmen and traders, and farmers. The rulers of Athens were called Archon. Archon was a chosen ruler who held permanent tenure at first. In 752 BC, it turned into a 10-year position, and then in 683 BC, it became a 1-year position. But even that did not change anything. The social inequality and class differences of the Athenians brought about the first sparks of change. The considerable growth in the number of non-Athenians and slaves was a serious threat to the Athenians. In fact, their lives depended on it. The nobility and landowners did almost nothing, but it was by the labor of the slaves that Athens was standing.
در آتن 400,000 نفر زندگی میکرد. 200,000 نفرش برده.
400,000 people lived in Athens. 200,000 of them were slaves. These slaves were either war prisoners or sold into slavery somehow, or transported to Athens from North Africa or other places, such as Phrygia or north of Greece, and were set to difficult works.
به هیچ وجه نه فقط به هیچ وجه از حقوق مساوی با دیگران.
They did not enjoy the same rights as other people of Athens, and even their life was in the hands of the eunuch or the person who owned them. 70,000 out of these 200,000 people were Metics. Metic is a Greek term which means stranger or foreigner. They were not slaves. Those foreigners were not slaves, but they were not considered ordinary citizens either.
There was a parliament that consisted of citizens, citizens who had already been purged, selected, and chosen. They did not include all the city residents.
The difference between smallholders and big landowners fanned the first flames of protests into life. The coalition of the Athenian farmers and craftsmen led the famous poet Solon to become the archon and managed to pass laws with his great authority. Solon's reforms divided the Athenians into four groups. Under his laws, the sale of debtors who could not pay their debts was forbidden, and slaves who had already been sold were returned to the country. The most important part of Solon's law was the creation of a council of 400 for selecting archons, in which everyone except women and slaves could vote and choose an archon from among nobles and traders. That was the first election in the world, the father of today's democracy.
یه جوان 18 ساله میتونه در اون تجمعی که در
An 18-year-old youth could join the crowd that had gathered in Athens in the place called Agora, the city's public square. He could express his opinion and criticize the government and judges. He could get people excited to incite that crowd. He could argue his opinions with other youth and older people. Anyone in general. He could meet influential government officials. It was something very exceptional.
Zinufuze dolati mitone roberu besh.
There were 12 tribes in Athens. Each one of them lived in a certain neighborhood in the city. Each one of these neighborhoods was called Dame, which means a place where a tribe or ethnic group lived. They were all related to each other. They were the free people of the city. Democracy meant their representatives had to rule.
Not anyone was allowed to take part. Who could take part? Noblemen, those who had Athenian origin. So women and slaves were excluded from decision-making and taking part in determining their own political, social, economic, and cultural fate.
They comprise 1/8 of the whole population of the city. The Athenian democracy belonged to 1/8 of the people.
So democracy at that time bore no relationship to our modern concept of democracy. It can be said that the only similarity found was that the people who were members of this tribe kept fighting each other and making decisions.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The British government in 2022 followed policies and laws that violated human rights without considering their consequences. This is while serious and explicit warnings were announced about the increase in food insecurity, increase in debt and decrease in social security, and rise of homelessness in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Human Rights Watch has denounced the British government for its ill treatment of women, refugees, demonstrators, welfare recipients and ethnic minorities, among other violations, warning officials that the country could become known as a human rights abuser if it did not correct a series of controversial laws. In its latest annual global report on human rights in 2022, Human Rights Watch condemned Britain's Conservative leaders for adopting a slew of measures last year that violated human rights on a range of issues, including the rights of asylum seekers, the rights of protesters, and the rights of ethnic groups. Human Rights Watch reported the British government in 2022 adopted laws that violated rights and proposed significantly weakening human rights protections in domestic law. Human Rights Watch added, the British government signed an agreement to transfer asylum seekers who arrived irregularly in the United Kingdom to Rwanda, putting them at risk. Rising food, rent and energy prices and inadequate social protections threatened the rights of people on the lowest incomes, including the right to food and the right to housing. The government failed to take meaningful steps to address institutional racism, including in policing. The Human Rights Watch report criticized Britain with regards to racism and ethnic discrimination. It said a British government policy paper published in April claimed that institutional racism had disappeared. However, the paper received widespread criticism from anti-discrimination groups. The report noted that in 2022, multiple reports from the United Kingdom cited the negative impact of institutional racism in various areas of life, including at work, particularly for women of colour, in parental and maternity care, the broader medical system, sports, policing, and mental health detention. The Independent Police Oversight Mechanism for England and Wales published recommendations in April for police to address the disproportionately discriminatory use of stop-and-search powers, citing data that black people were 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people. Britain's leaders have pinned much of the problems on the COVID-19 pandemic. However, critics say Britain's ruling Conservative Party's incompetence and leadership instability has plunged the country in its current dire straits. The British newspaper The Guardian has also reported on the same story. According to the international NGO Human Rights Watch, the British government could soon make the list of countries that abuse rather than protect human rights, with its outright assault on the rights of its own citizens and aggressive rollback of protections such as on the right to assemble and protest. Tirana Hassan, the acting executive director of Human Rights Watch, said, "The shrinking civic space is not relegated to countries far away. When you come to the United Kingdom, you look at the very worrying trend we are seeing. A slew of legislation was passed last year where fundamental human rights are being challenged. The protest law is something we're deeply concerned about." Tirana Hassan said Human Rights Watch had identified a worrying trend by the British government of proposing laws that violate human rights and significantly weaken protections. Tirana Hassan added, "When you talk about civic space and about people's right to participate in a democratic society, the right to peacefully assemble and the right to protest are key pillars of that. We've seen an outright assault from this government on that." She said the British government had a very short window to reverse some of its decisions before it joins the countries listed as human rights abusers rather than human rights protectors. Yasmin Ahmad, the UK director at Human Rights Watch, said 2022 saw the most significant assault on human rights protections in the United Kingdom in decades. In a section on the United Kingdom, Human Rights Watch's 2023 global report, a detailed assessment of the human rights landscape across the world, raises grave concerns over laws either proposed or already in force. They are the Public Order Bill, which would restrict the right to protest and increase penalties, the Elections Act, requiring voter identification, the law limiting people's rights to judicially review social security and immigration decisions, and the Nationality and Borders Act, which criminalizes asylum seekers taking irregular routes, increases powers to strip people of citizenship, and allows offshore processing